Hey everybody, welcome to today's episode of Canada Uncut. This episode is called Rootedness, a podcast dedicated to decolonizing, unlearning, and growing in Indigenous knowledge and resilience. I'm Maya Crawford, and alongside me is Shannon McQuaid. This podcast is an affiliation with the First Nations Child and Family Care Society. Today's episode is specifically investigating Indigenous cultural and language resurgence in so-called Canada, and the conflict between so-called Canada's commitments to truth and reconciliation and the Official Languages Act. For this topic, we have the opportunity to speak with Dr. Marianne Corbière.
Dr. Marianne Corbière is a professor with the University of Sudbury and has a PhD in theory and policy studies in education at the University of Toronto. She is an author and a longstanding teacher of Anishinaabemowin in university, and she grew up on Manitoulin Island. Dr. Corbière has been invited here today to discuss the history of assimilation of Indigenous peoples by preventing their spoken languages and her experiences with the lack of recognition of Indigenous languages in the Official Languages Act, as well as her recommendations for supporting Indigenous language resurgence, especially in children. Welcome, Dr. Corbière.
So we're here with Marianne, and the first thing I'm going to ask is just if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and the lived experiences that you hold related to this topic and your life.
Okay, my background. I grew up with my people's language, Anishinaabemowin, as my first language. That was the language of our home, and it was the dominant language when I was growing up in our community in the 1960s. I started grade one in 1961, so that's where my memories go back to. I don't recall much before 1960. I think very few people, well, most people were bilingual by then, bilingual in our language and English, because of course our parents had learned English mainly through residential school. The ones on Manitoulin Island, they went to the one that was located in Spanish Ontario across the North Channel. And then our education, grade one, right on up, we were taught just in English. So in a sense, before we knew the word immersion, we learned a second language by immersion in the classroom. But out in the schoolyard at recess time, and of course after school when we're playing with our friends, almost all the kids I knew, all my classmates, everybody in the schools, almost everybody spoke the language as their first language. There were a few families where the kids did not speak the language, although the parents did. And those tended to be, from what I noticed, teachers' families. My own teacher from grade one to four, she was from the community. Her husband is from the community. They both grew up with a language as their first language, but they were raising their kids in English. And another family in the village as well, also a family where one of the parents was in the field of education, an educator. They likewise were. And the wife, too, was from, again, originally from my home community, grew up there, Anishinaabemowin as their first language. They were raising their kids in English. So those were the only two that I noticed where the kids did not speak our language. I think in terms of the Official Languages Act, during that time, we weren't really cognizant of that. Now, this would be, I suspect, due to our community is one of the larger Anishinaabemowin communities, or one of the larger Indigenous communities in Canada. Its membership in the 1960s might have been in the range of 4,000 in the 1980s, when I was working there, I think our band population was being stated as in the range of 5,000 or so, including both on-reserve and off-reserve members. Those of us who are living permanently on the reserve Yeah, language, Anishinaabemowin was just, that was just our language. It was our first language. English was just the language of school. And of course, the language of TV. So we didn't, the only, I guess, bearing that the Official Languages Act had indirectly was, it was the National Indian Brotherhood's response to the then Minister of Indian Affairs proposed paper. They called it the White Paper, which basically, set out to do away with the distinct status of, at the time, as we were called, Indians. Yeah, so that was the National Indian Brotherhood's response. And in part of that response was that education, Native students, Native kids needed to be also educated about their culture and their languages. So I think that provided a major impetus for the establishment of Native language teaching of Native languages as a subject in the K-12 system. And of course, eventually post-secondary as well. And part of also what came out of the National Indian Brotherhood's initiatives was also turning over the administration of band governments, bands over to the First Nations themselves. Well, back then we were still called Indian bands. So those talks were happening in the 1970s. And by the time I came home from university, my undergraduate degree in 1979, shortly the band was already talking about assuming control, administrative control of its education programs. We had our own schools because we were, like I said, a fairly sizable community. We didn't have to go off reserve for at least until grade 8. We went off reserve for grade 9 for high school. So they were in the process of, while they were looking into that and they had decided, yeah, they were going to work towards assuming administrative responsibility for our education. So in the context of those discussions, yeah, people by then were well aware that, well, they'd been working with Indian Affairs, that French was the other official language. I'm only speaking from my own experiences and observations from growing up and coming back home to Wiquemcong after university. They were talking about taking over the education program themselves. So part of that was, okay, what kinds of subjects should be taught? So among the discussions was, okay, a native language, I guess, was assumed to be, okay, it would be one of the subjects probably, but there was some discussions about that, eh? Okay. And there were some had the opinion that, okay, well, if we're going to be teaching another language to our kids, they would be better served by French. Way they can have a chance of getting a, quote, good government job. End quote. Yeah, because back in the day, in terms of our economic development and so on, yeah, there were still not very many people that had been able to go on to university. There were not many people in any of the professions.
Yeah.
What was perceived as like a family doing well was a family like that had a teacher in it.
Yeah.
Or the woman was a secretary somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, like we weren't yet having doctors and lawyers and engineers coming out of our communities. Like those kinds of professions seem beyond the realm of possibility to many of the young at that time. And then, of course, there were some people like Indian Affairs had some Indigenous staff. So again, steady government job. Steady income, better income. So like those were the broader, I guess, societal dynamics. I think that would have influenced some of the community members' views about, okay, how do we better serve? How do we help ensure that our children have a better life?
Mm-hmm.
And we do. Okay. And so English, of course, was recognized for its value. And then French was recognized as by some as, yeah, that would be a really good asset too. Now, the other part of the dynamic that sort of influenced that discussion was we were all fluent. Most of the people around the council table, around the education committee table, And I was a member of the education committee for a few years when this this takeover was happening. We were all, our language was our first language. Discussions weren't happening in English. People weren't cognizant of the different, how readily language is learned by kids versus how hard it is for learning it past a certain critical age.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't aware of that literature. So I think people assumed that, well, we learned our language easily and we learned English. Our kids, yeah, while they have a chance in school to learn French, let them learn French, they can always pick up our language later. That was the kind of remark you'd hear now and then. Later being after high school, after they, the primary concern was we got to get, we have to increase our graduation rates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a, our graduation rates from high school were lower than the Canadian average. I'm sure you've come across the statistics.
Yeah.
So that was the main, that was a major problem that they were wanting addressed through by taking over education. We want to ensure that our kids complete high school at least and ideally go on to post-secondary.
Kind of to go off on that. So like part of that fits in really well with saying that kind of French and English became a sign of being able to have like an economically stable job. Like to have some type of economic success.
Exactly.
Yeah. So learning those languages became like a sign of success, sort of, rather than having your own language and being able to just have that type of success in your own languages and identities.
Yeah. And from a sociolinguistic perspective, there is the issue of prestige as well. I mean, mm-hmm. if you finish school and you were operating in English, you were perceived as, it's like, you were smart.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the colonial trope just being.
Yeah. Really, yeah. And the unfortunate thing is even like, yeah, again, taking our language for granted because we learned it basically effortlessly. I mean, when it's your first language, you're not actually being taught it. You're acquiring mm-hmm. it because that's all you hear in the home from the day you're born. Yeah, it's because it was so taken for granted. It's like the perception in a few people's minds, at least, is that it doesn't take much intelligence. And it's just this, again, because when we're kids, it seemed effortless to us, therefore easy. It doesn't take much intelligence, you know, whereas English took effort. So therefore, if you did well, you spoke English well and wrote English well, then you were perceived as, okay, smart person. Yeah, so that's very unfortunate.
Yeah, now it's the flip side, right? Now I see with the resurgence coming back, even my own father, right, trying to relearn the language, and it's tough. It's exactly. The opposite now, right? There's such a call out for traditional language teachers, so it's just so interesting how the colonial legacy just continues on.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what, it's always, you know, the struggle.
Yeah. And that kind of feeds into like a question that we have for you about kind of wondering, like, do these barriers or maybe different barriers still like persist with regards to like, you know, utilizing Indigenous language in like, say, university, or utilizing them in other aspects of your life, or if individuals want to go into, you know, maybe they want to work in the government and you know, or work with the government. And we are just kind of curious, like, how these barriers might still persist today, and like may continue to persist if things don't change, kind of.
This answer has to be two-sided, because for those, it depends on where you want to work. Yeah, I guess just sometimes I'd feel a sense of that. Well, I am sort of imposing on people by having them need to switch to English to ensure I understand, you know, and it, of course, it's disheartening to anyone who sets out to learn something that they can't learn it, whatever the topic is.
Yeah. And probably a bit like isolating identity-wise, in the sense of being like not being able to speak a language necessarily that some other people can in your faculty, right?
Yeah. So. The question of isolating, yeah, that's a tricky one, because I think we tend to naturally self-isolate.
Yeah.
Because when you see a bunch of Anishinaabeg in a big non-Indigenous context, they immediately make a beeline for each other, and next thing you know, they're talking as if they're lifelong old friends.
Fair enough.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Like, it's just a natural way we act. And we're just so glad to see another Nish in the mix.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. We are doing this podcast in relation to the First Nations Child and Family
Right.
Society. And just thinking about urban centers as well, and how a lot of Indigenous youth now are in these urban centers and have the disconnect from community as well. What do you think, especially because you have worked in the university setting as well, how do you think that these Indigenous youth can be supported in their journeys to learning and rediscovering their languages?
That is another two-pronged or multi-pronged answer. Yeah. It all depends on the person, because the thing I do find problematic is that, because there's so much talk about the connection between language and identity, I have, unfortunately, on occasion, now people, when they say this, the few people I've heard say this, say it in a joking way, but it can be taken also by a young person who's in the process of figuring out who they are. It can be taken in a very serious way. And of course, these young people now, they don't have the language through no fault of their own. It's not as if they jettisoned it. Yeah. They just didn't have the opportunities. So part of what many of them are doing to reconnect with their culture is practicing, starting to participate in ceremonies, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Our communities are very culturally diverse.
Mm-hmm.
Internally, because I mean, whatever people might think about the Christian influence, it has had a pervasive influence. So in some communities, at least, there are a good proportion of the community considers themselves Christian, and they don't see that as problematic. Of course, the experiences that occurred at residential schools were problematic, but they don't see that as because of the faith. They see it as because of the individuals, you know, like there's always, like, not everybody is perfect. There's always somebody who does something bad.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who did good. So I think they have they don't overgeneralize. So for them, like people of my mother's generation, like back home, for them, Catholicism is still the way they pray, and weddings are done as Catholic. I guess that the youth today who don't have the language lack it through no fault of their own, and their culture, traditional culture, is a large part of how they are connecting back to their identity.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes some speakers will remark to a young person, like a young nephew or a young niece, it's like, you say you're Anishinaabe because of your participation in Sundance and so on and so forth, but you don't even speak the language.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, for me, it's like, don't tell people, don't say that to people. That is mean. Mm-hmm. It's not their fault. They didn't choose to not speak their language. You know, they were deprived of this through all these complex historical forces, colonization being a major one. I've had students in classes for whom regaining the language has become really critically important. And at the same time, unfortunately, I mean, every individual has certain aptitudes. Mm-hmm. And some people just have a hard time learning another language as an adult. And our youth, if they had Anishinaabe when immersion available to them, they at least could have known it quite well.
Yeah.
You know, maybe they might not have had the oral proficiency in it. I would always feel so bad for those Anishinaabe students who would expressed to me that this language and getting this language back is really important to them. And then I would see how they would struggle. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And they would have to work so hard for so long to develop a high proficiency in it. It would have to be a really determined effort. Eh?
Yeah.
And life is complicated. People have young kids. You can't go and disappear into an Anishinaabe community. Very few can go into an Anishinaabe speaking community for 3 years or however long it might take to really attain that kind of proficiency. Eh?
Yeah.
And for those in urban contexts, I mean, yeah, roughly 50%, maybe even more than 50% from what I recall of statistics of the indigenous population is urban. Yeah. And when you're so far away from your community, and at this stage, it might even be irrelevant whether you're far away from your community, because at this stage, in many communities, there are very few fluent speakers remaining because there is that abrupt, you know, like, what's the term? The language shift between generations. Most of the speakers, like, and I speak of my own family, you know, my siblings, they raised their kids in English, although both parents spoke the language. People in the urban contexts, where do you go?
Mm-hmm.
Except scrounge around for language resources anywhere and everywhere you can find them. And there's a fair number of things online now, but like going back to the state of the language, if our parents or grandparents had foreseen the day that their language would be eroded so badly, perhaps they would have decided to produce more written materials in the language. The written materials we had until the 1970s were mainly prayer books. And that's the extent of the reading they did.
Mm-hmm.
The language is almost entirely oral, apart from that.
That definitely brings up like a really interesting like point of like, do you think that it would be helpful if, Indigenous services or Crown Indigenous relations, government services offered like services in your language, for instance, or any other Indigenous languages? Do you think that would help in the resurgence of these languages?
It would certainly, I think, enhance the prestige of Indigenous languages. Although I think these days they do have a lot of prestige.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah, because of just the awareness that people have of what the loss of a language signifies.
Mm-hmm.
I think the relatively few people who have tackled learning an Indigenous language as adults appreciate, learning this language, knowing this language is not a mark of lack of intelligence. In fact, it takes an awful lot of brain power to figure out this language and how to make sense in it. Let alone how to make sense putting ideas together, but also how to make sense in terms of pronunciation. This is a very different language. So I think that they have prestige now in recognition of that they are equally complex in different ways as English and French are.
So just kind of going back to some of the things that you said about, having the language written down, with newspapers or dictionaries or having those prayers in the written language, do you think what was your experience with translating the Ottawa Eastern Ojibwe Dictionary? And then what was your biggest takeaway from that experience? And how do you think that maybe contributed or could contribute to the resurgence of Indigenous language, in particularly youth, but in the general broader sense of community?
I think the biggest takeaway I have from that is just from writing the dictionary is just my awareness that we really need a big, huge corpus of literature. And I always go back to the example of my kids in French immersion. They heard it from the teacher. That's all she spoke to them in. And the school library had books at various reading levels that they could borrow and bring home. When you read stories of whatever kind, you know, just from the general, the way the story is unfolding, the terms you see in a dictionary, you get a better sense of how they can be used in real life speech. Mm-hmm. And how we use words is often radically different from what a dictionary suggests. I mean, dictionaries are good in that they document the lexicon. They document the meanings of words at a given time, whenever the dictionary is being written. In a vibrant speech community, and especially youth, the language usage morphs, the context behind a story. Yeah, that shows all these things and how meanings can change over time. Yeah, literature, it's just like dictionary is just a small component of language revitalization or resurgence. All it can do is give a sketch of the language, list, here's the words that exist in this language, and it can include some example sentences.
Everything that you've said thus far, like it perfectly encapsulates this idea of like language as part of both part of identity, a central part of identity, and also in making identity and how you identify, not just as an individual, but like with your community. Because in some cultures and some languages, like the inflection, like the joking aspect of sarcasm doesn't even exist. So mm-hmm. it's really interesting, like being able to have this conversation with you and put in the forefront this idea that yes, language is central to identity, but also learning language and being part of the culture, they're integral to becoming to the resurgence of Indigenous identity, if that makes sense, or the resurgence of Indigenous language.
Yeah, I just find that so really complex, eh? Because even culture, when people talk about language and culture, I think, okay, let's consider, what do we mean when we say culture? And I think this sort of relates to what I said about the a good proportion of the Indigenous community having accepted, well, I guess it was their ancestors that accepted Christianity, but that was the faith that was passed on. I mean, I think you'd be, it would be fighting words to suggest to those elders that they're not really Anishinaabe.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Just as it ought to be fighting words to those youth when you tell them that you're not really Anishinaabe because you don't have your language. I mean, this identity thing is such a multidimensional aspect. And same with when you talk about the link with a community. I mean, the way our life is now, like you are potentially part of a member of so many different communities.
Just ask if you could describe what language means to you in one word, what would that be?
For me, it means a connection rooted, well, maybe in one word, rootedness. It signifies where I came from, and that my blood, part of my blood, my genes, can be traced back to whenever, however far back my very, very far back ancestor came across on the Bering Land Bridge.
No, that's amazing. And I just want to say thank you so much for speaking to us and telling us your story today. And always conversations like this, I just love the storytelling and the learning. So thank you.
It's amazing. I learned so much personally, and I'm sure Maya, you feel the same. And we're very happy with how this came out. And we're just like, thank you very much for coming and teaching us so much in just the short time that we had. So much wisdom and just like such a short period of time. I'm having my trouble wrapping my head around it.
Dr. Corbière, thank you for being so open and honest in sharing your personal stories and expertise in Indigenous language and resilience. Maya and I really enjoyed our conversation, and if you enjoyed that conversation, please like and follow. This podcast is available through the Ventures Initiative and is in affiliation with the First Nations Child and Family Care Society. Please check out their website and future projects to see what they're doing for Indigenous children across Turtle Island. Until next time, in solidarity and resilience.